Why don't we go ahead and get started? And you know how it is. I try not to talk too fast, but I also have lots of material. So that's the way it is. We're going to do two chapters this week. Next week, we're actually doing four chapters. Yeah. So I won't be able to get into as much detail in four chapters, but there isn't a lot of detail to really analyze in those four chapters. So let's start here. The tribulation. This is the beginning of the tribulation called the Seal Judgments. And let me just remind you of the website. I don't know why it takes so long to cross over, but the website that I've set up has some stuff on it. This is this week's. Here's this required homework, which some of you didn't do, but that's okay. PowerPoint class notes, I put all those on there. And then audio recording of the class, I'll do that at the end of the class. I'll be recording today and putting that at the end of the class. Then next time is the seven trumpet judgments. Things are really going to start to heat up. Inside the seventh seal, which we actually don't talk about till next week because it's not in six or seven. The seventh seal is like there's a pause and there's a seventh seal. Inside the seventh seal are all the trumpets. And then inside the seventh trumpet are all the bowl judgments. And so we'll be laying those out as we go. I also have suggested preparation for next time. I didn't put it required. Maybe you'll be more inclined to listen to it if it's not required. He talks about the seventh seal there. It's not a John MacArthur sermon, which
so
he's really good.
Could you send us, or is that in the link?
Yeah, just click the link.
It's in the sound.
Where do I got to go?
Oh, this is sound-doctrine.us. Sound-doctrine.us.
Write it in your book.
Yeah, just, yeah.
But you sent us something.
Right?
Yeah,
oh, I sent you that link. Yeah, I sent you your homework in the email. Yeah. Okay. That's what you're talking about. Okay. So come on in.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't or does?
It doesn't matter.
So let me ask you a question. Let's review quickly last week, okay? Last week was 4 and 5. Chapters 4 and 5. God is seated on his throne in majesty, and he's surrounded by four living beings. And remember, those living beings were really kind of weird, right? We are shown a scroll, and the only person in the entire universe found worthy to break its seals and open the scroll was who?
Jesus.
Yeah, the Lamb. Yeah. What does the scroll represent?
Title deed.
Yeah, so it's like the title deed is a legal document. Represents a legal document to the planet or the universe, if you want to call it that, because the whole universe has subjected to corruption, right? Inside the scroll is what? What does it contain? Remember, the scroll's got seven seals.
The witnesses.
It's a list of the things that are going to happen in order for Jesus to take back what's rightfully his. And I didn't show you this last one, but this is last week. I added something up here. This is the one that was originally on Revelation 4 and 5. You notice how it's one scroll with seven seals? I found this. Because people are wondering, how is it that you take off one seal and then shoo, and another seal and shoo? So that kind of makes it. Anyway. Yeah, that's, you know, and I wasn't there, so I don't know. So anyway. Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
How you doing, Dan? All right. So it contains a description of how Jesus will claim back what is rightfully his. Remember, we talked about squatters and those kinds of things last time. And now, in chapters 6 and 7, the Lamb is about to open the seals one by one. Every time he opens a seal, something happens. So the question is, who did their homework? Who listened to that John MacArthur message? What'd you think of it? There's a great overview there about the coming world government and the new world order, and what are the reasons that people want this, right?
Yeah.
Does anybody remember the reasons? This is not a quiz. I'm just wondering if you remember.
Peace.
Yeah. What's wrong with that, right? World peace. Yeah.
Yeah.
Equity, equitable distribution of wealth. In many ways, it's about control. It's about power. I have a list of things here. Equity distribution of wealth with the elites controlling the flow of money. That's about power and control. Currency control, if you eliminate cash and all transactions are tracked, then nobody can be off grid. In fact, it's crypto. With crypto now, you can do that. So cryptocurrency, I don't know if you know, but the currency itself travels with a history of where it's been. You can see everything. Okay. Environmental control, using climate change to influence people's behavior. They're doing that already. Global taxation, no company can move to a country with lower taxes. Like, a lot of companies move to Ireland because their tax rates are really low. Microsoft moved there, they got a big setup over there.
Fannie Willis wouldn't want the cash.
Yeah, right? Yeah, she's cash only for sure. Global crisis response, and I think the COVID pandemic was a pretest for what global crisis response would be, right? Open migration, free of borders. Are we seeing that anywhere? No national identity. This is all stuff that they want. It's not by mistake. Okay. Elimination of unsanctioned religion. What's the sanctioned religion going to be?
Humanism.
It's basically going to be the Antichrist. Yeah. No nations, religious homogeny. So no more wars, world peace. And this is what they're trying to achieve. They're trying to achieve world peace, and they think they can do it this way. Right. Come on in. So why is one world government and one world rule a bad idea? Did you get that from that sermon? Why is one world government a bad idea? Because that's what Jesus is going to do, right? Jesus is going to rule the earth from Jerusalem for 1,000 years as a theocracy. Okay? Why is one world government of man a bad idea?
Well, since man is flawed.
Flawed. He's more than flawed. When I see something on the news, I'm like, oh, that person is flawed.
Like Tower of Babel. I mean, that's why he confused the language.
Exactly. So he brought up the point of the Tower of Babel. Yep. Man said to spread across the whole earth, and the people that all had the same language said, oh, we want to do that. Just hang out here in Babel and build stuff, right? The other problem is that man is inherently sinful. And if you don't have nations putting other nations in check, then there's no balance. There's no, you can't stop an evil empire, okay? Yeah, I mean, where would the empire be without the rebellion? The empire would take over, right? But you've got the rebellion, and they're trying to keep the empire down. There's a balance there, but not if everybody owns everything. So God's plan is to establish his one world government, and that's a theocracy, not a democracy or a kleptocracy or whatever you call it. So... yeah, dictatorship. So tonight we're going to look at 6 of the 7 seals opened. 6 of the 7 seals. The opening of these seals represents an outline of consecutive future events. Okay, so these events haven't happened yet. We're not living in the tribulation right now. But it shows you what's going to happen. I'm going to try to give you the timeline so you can see what's going on. But they can be seen as epochs. Sort of periods of time when certain things happen, and we can define what things happen during those periods of time. According to Daniel, Matthew, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, the Antichrist comes to power at the start of the tribulation, promising peace and safety. And that's what this whole one world government's all about. Hey, we can bring you peace. Are you tired of the wars? Everybody's tired of war. Nobody wants war. Well, we can bring you peace. And the first 6 seals are in chapter 6. And they parallel Jesus' Olivet Discourse, which is found in Matthew 24. So you'll see a lot of parallels between Matthew 24 and Revelation 6. Now, let me try to lay this out for you before we dig in so you've got a better idea of what's going on. Come on in. So this is what Jesus refers to. So this is 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th. These are the seals, okay? This is the period of the tribulation. And the beginning of the birth pangs occupies more or less the first half. So the first 3.5 years of tribulation was what Jesus calls the beginning of birth pangs. Some people think that we're in the beginning of birth pangs now. We haven't seen anything yet. When you're about to have a baby, you know it's getting kind of rough, and it gets rougher all the time, right? So 3.5 years, this is the beginning of birth pangs, first 3.5 years of tribulation. And then the second half, and I know this is not equally divided, but the second half of the tribulation is called the Great Tribulation, which basically starts at the midpoint of the tribulation, and that's the second 3.5 years. And then here you can see the correlation. The first seal brings the Antichrist with a false peace. That's Matthew 24, 4-5. You've got a white horse, a world leader bringing unity. Second seal, worldwide war. So peace is followed by war. That peace doesn't last very long. That's Matthew 24, 6 and 7, red horse. The false peace fails, bringing war. And then the third seal, famine, and that's the black horse, and we're going to talk about all this, worldwide food shortages. The fourth seal, death, Matthew 24, 7 again, divine judgment, that's pale horse, a fourth of the people are killed. Now, a fourth of the people, there are 8 billion people on this planet right now. That's 2 billion people. And that's, you know, that's starting to get into the second half here. So you can see that things really get crazy over here in the second half. And then the fifth seal, you see martyrs under the throne of God, under the altar of God, actually, and they cry out to him. You see that in Matthew 24:9. Divine judgment is proclaimed on the evil ones. And then the sixth seal, earthquakes and darkness. But it's more than earthquakes and darkness, and we're going to see that in a minute. Rulers hide underground in fear of Christ, and they actually call for the mountains to fall on them because they finally figure out, down in here somewhere, sort of towards the end of the tribulation, they just think it's bad times on planet Earth. And they finally figure out, wait a minute, God's in this, and he's against us, right? So then you get a pause in judgment while 144,000 Jewish evangelists are sealed on their foreheads for protection. Very interesting, because the Antichrist has a seal, or a mark, if you want to call it that. God has a mark, too. He's going to mark his faithful. And then there's the seventh seal, which we're going to talk about next time, and that's the trumpet and bowl judgments from Matthew 24:37. And these are cataclysmic events. The earth is essentially ransacked. I mean, just messed up big time, and we'll see that next time. You know, I'm all for, you know, saving the planet and recycling bottles and stuff like that. But when I see what God's going to do to this planet, you know, this is a disposable planet. I don't know if you made that point in the sermon, but the earth, it's disposable. It's like a bottle that you throw away, and I hate to make it so trivial as that, but the beauty of it is he's going to bring a new heavens and a new earth, okay? Any questions about that real quick while we're looking at it? Yeah.
So I know that the Antichrist comes after we're taken, but do you think that we'll have a sense of who that is going to be, or is he going to be hidden until we're gone?
So the Daniel talks about a little horn. Horns represent power. Daniel talks about a little horn that arises, and the little horn means he's kind of insignificant. And that's what's really strange about him. He kind of comes out of nowhere, like Hitler did. Or even Barack Obama was a nobody until he became president. So this leader just kind of comes up out of nowhere and takes over. Now, if the tribulation's in the next 10 or 20 years, he's alive right now.
So we could know of him, but he might not.
Right. You might know who he is. Exactly. And I need to make this point. He's just a man. But he's a man empowered by Satan. So that's not something to be trifled with.
He could be in kindergarten right now.
He could be in high school right now. Yeah. Yeah. So, John MacArthur is pre-trib, and I became pre-trib. I don't know, 20 years ago. Jim and I were talking about that, but I listened to a sermon of his where he said, "Now a lot of people believe that the tribulation happens at the end of the rapture happens at the end of the tribulation," and he said, "And I get that. I get why you see that." So he acknowledges that there can be other positions, but when you're a pastor, you have to take a position, and you have to base it on what you see in the Word. And so that's why we're looking at it from a pre-tribulation rapture standpoint. And when you see what goes on the planet, I don't know why God would want us to go through that, but we're called to stand firm no matter what we go through, right? So let's jump in to chapter 6. Let me just open prayer. Father, thank you so much for giving us once again this time together as we open your word. You pronounce a blessing on those who read it and listen to the words that are herein, and we pray that you would give us wisdom, that you give us understanding, Father, that it wouldn't be concealed to us. It would be open to us. That's what revelation means. And so we're grateful to you for every moment that we have in your word and for everyone that's here tonight. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. So Revelation 6, 1 to 2. Then I saw when the Lamb broke one of the seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying, as with a voice of thunder, "Come." I looked, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. Now, when you first see that, you think, oh, that must be Jesus. I mean, he's on a white horse, you know, he's going out to conquer. But there's a couple problems with that view, and we'll take a look at those as we go. So what does a white horse signify to you? Yeah, I pulled this off. This lady, Maria Mariotte, takes these pictures of horses. They're gorgeous. She wrote this, and she got it from somewhere. The legend of the white stallion is an ancient story that has been passed down through generations. According to the legend, if one were to, against all odds, find and ride this mythical creature, they would be granted great power and success. So those are key words there, great power and success. In some retellings, the white stallion is believed to be a symbol of freedom, courage, strength, and purity, as well as a sign of hope for, in times of difficulty. This legend has been a part of human history for centuries, and the white horse has been featured in mythology, folklore, and literature around the world, from the Celtic legend of the white stallion to the Native American story of the white horse. This creature has become a powerful symbol and has inspired large bodies of work. So you can understand, horses are amazing creatures. I mean, you'll get a horse, you're like, wow, what a design, right? It's so good. Why God would use a horse, why Jesus would use a horse to portray this person coming in. Let me just ask you a couple of questions here, though. What horse does the knight in shining armor ride?
White horse.
Typically a white horse, right? He's coming to save or to get the damsel in distress or whatever. What horse did the Lone Ranger ride? So some of you who know who the Lone Ranger is are going to reveal your age. Yeah, Silver is kind of a white horse, right? So the white horse represents power, authority, someone riding in victory or triumph. It's a sign and hope in times of difficulty. And this imagery represents a period of time in the future. And when is that time? So Daniel says that he will make a firm covenant with the many, which he's meaning the Jews because he's talking to his own people, for 1 week, in the middle of the week, and these weeks are weeks of years, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. So it seems like there's a peace treaty that he makes, and he also allows the Jews to set up the sanctuary with their sacrifices in the temple, and then he puts an end to it, kind of cancels that treaty. Jesus said that many would come claiming to be Christ, misleading many. In Matthew 24:5, it says, for many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and will mislead many. Paul told the Thessalonians that people would be saying peace and safety. There's a lot of that in the New Testament. Peace and safety, peace and safety. That's what we want to hear. We don't want any more wars. We don't want Gaza. We don't want Ukraine. We don't want any of that stuff. We want peace. 1 Thessalonians 5:1-3 says, now as to the times and the epochs, brethren, you have no need of anything to be written to you. In other words, he's not saying you don't need to know it because you already do. He's saying you don't really need to know it, right? Whatever you know is all you need to know. For you yourselves know full well that the day of the Lord will come just like a thief in the night. And that's where that expression comes, the thief in the night. While they are saying peace and safety, then destruction will come upon them suddenly like labor pains upon a woman with child. Come on in, ladies. And they will not escape.
Yes, sir. We're sorry.
And they will come in late.
We apologize.
Second Thessalonians 2:3 says this, let no one in any way deceive you. Let no one in any way deceive you, for it will not come unless the apostasy comes first and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction. So what Paul is telling us here in 2 Thessalonians that this man who's coming won't come until the apostasy comes first. What's apostasy?
Falling away from the church.
Yeah.
I think that's dark.
You think so? Studies conducted by the Barna Group in USA Today found that nearly 75% of Christian young people fall away from the faith and leave the church after high school. That's an article from September. 75%. We got young people back there. Not these young people. No. 40 million Americans have stopped attending church in the past 25 years. That's something like 12% of the population, and it represents the largest concentrated change in church attendance in American history. That comes from The Atlantic, July 29, 2023. Mainstream evangelicals dropped out because they moved, 22%. Or services were inconvenient, 16%, but also because they did not feel much love in the church. Evangelicals in this study left because they did not fit in. 23% of evangelicals don't fit into their church because they did not feel much love in the congregation. That's 18%. Because of negative experiences with evangelicals, that's 15%. I'm an evangelical and I got a problem with another evangelical. I'm going to leave the church. And then because they no longer believed, 14%. Whoa. And this comes from an article in the Washington Post, also in September, called The Great De-Churching, looks at why people are leaving the churches.
Did you know that on TikTok, there were over 6,000 videos from ex-believers leaving Christianity?
Yeah, there's a name for them.
To tell people.
Yeah.
And there's over 100,000 videos on the deconstruction of Christianity and why it's bad.
Yeah.
We were just talking about this in our life group Sunday.
Yeah. So there's a name for them. You know what the name is? Ex-evangelicals.
Really?
Ex-evangelicals.
Because they decide they're not Christian.
They're like, I was an evangelical once, and it was cool for a while, but now I'm an ex-evangelical.
Oh. Isn't that the person that can never regain their
Christian? Now, that's a can of worms you're about to open there. So...
I think I read that.
Paul says that those who have once been enlightened and once who have tasted the heavenly gift who have fallen away, it's impossible to lead them back to repentance because they're doing what? They're crucifying all over again the Son of God. Well, Jesus was crucified once for all. You can't just keep crucifying over and over again. So you basically put him to open shame. So, yes, you know, being an evangelical doesn't mean you're saved. It just means you're an evangelical, right? Mm-hmm. So we like to think that. We like to think we're in a church full of saved people, but there's a ton of people in every church that are not saved. And they're just kind of going along with the program, right?
We wouldn't need the church.
Yep. So what is apostasy? The Christian share of the U.S. population is declining, while the number of U.S. adults who do not identify with any organized religion is growing, according to an extensive new survey by the Pew Research Center. And this is from 2015. But if you look here, this top line, this is evangelical Protestant. 7-year stretch, dropped from 26 to 25. Catholic dropped from 24 basically to 20. Those who are unaffiliated over 7 years went from 16% to 22%. And then you've got non-Christian faiths, and that includes Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, other world religions, and other faiths, going up from 4.7 to 5.9. So I'm not going to look at that and say, well, this is a huge apostasy, but it is apostasy. It really is. And we're not even in a time of trouble. We're not even being persecuted. You should see what will happen when the church gets persecuted. People are going to jump out like rats because they're like, oh, I don't want this. I don't want the police knocking on my door in the middle of the night with AR-15s and call me out of my house to question me. So that's tough. So it said here, if I go back here to here, it said, he who sat on it had a bow. And a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. What's a bow? What's that for?
He had no arrows.
That's what?
A weapon. He had no arrows.
Oh, wait. You're right. What good's a bow without arrows?
Fiery
arrows. Boing. I mean, there's no arrows, right? So a bow is a weapon of war, but it's like a gun without bullets. What good is a gun without bullets? So a lot of people, when they try to say that this is Jesus coming in, first of all, Jesus has never, ever, ever, ever been with just a bow and no arrows. He's always with a sword, okay? And what does it mean that he had a bow and no arrows? What kind of conquering is that if you're not using arrows?
You don't need a
fight. Right.
Surrenders.
Oh, they surrender, or you could say a diplomatic solution or whatever. Hey, come over to my side. We can guarantee you world peace. All we have to do is do one world currency, one world religion, one world government. Okay?
Deception.
Huh?
Deception.
It's deception, obviously. Yeah. That's one of the elements of the characteristics of the Antichrist is deception. So, crown was given to him. This is someone with political power, but who doesn't really engage militarily. That's the idea there. It can't be Christ, because Christ is never pictured with a bow. He's always pictured with a sword, and the sword has two edges because it cuts both ways. How about this? A crown was given to him. So the Greek word for crown here is Stephanos. Stephanos. It's not a kingly crown. Not a kingly crown. It's a crown given for victory in games, for military valor, for presented as an award. That's a Stephanos. Jesus doesn't wear a Stephanos. He wears diadems. It's a different word for crown. You see, sometimes where English just falls so short, because the Greeks have two different words for crowns, and they mean very different things. Diadems, it's a crown signifying royalty. So Jesus wears crowns, but he wears diadems, and many, not just one. And he went out conquering and to conquer. So the sense here is that the rider is conquering, perhaps through diplomacy. Yeah, the rider on the white horse represents a false Christ or the Antichrist. Okay. So then, any questions on the first seal? You open the first seal, and out comes a white horse with a rider and a bow with no arrows and a crown on his head. It's a leader. He's some kind of leader. Revelation 3.
So
what's that?
Part of the time, you know, like the first seal to the fourth seal, I guess. We don't know exactly how long it's going to be, but this is a time of peace, and then comes the second seal.
Yeah, we don't know how long it's going to be until, because the red horse brings war. The white horse brought peace, the red horse brings war. We don't know how long it's going to take for that peace to unravel. The Bible isn't clear. Daniel doesn't tell us. We know that the tribulation is a week of years, which is seven. We know that something happens in the midpoint, but we don't know the playing out of each of these. We're pretty sure that it's in this order, right? Peace, war, famine, death, and we'll get to that. So this, when he broke the second seal, I heard the second living creature saying, come, and I heard, another, a red horse, went out, and to him who sat on it was granted to take peace from the earth. Now, the fact that he's taking peace means that there must have been peace, right? There must have been peace, at least for a time, and everyone's like, yay, we got a new world leader, and everything's awesome, and peace, okay? So it was granted to him to take peace from the earth, and that men would slay one another, and a great sword was given to him. Now, this one's got a sword. So that means war. The red horse typically means war. Red for war, or for blood, if you want to call it that, which follows a time of initial peace. So this emphasizes, let's see what I got here. I'll give you even more notes today because I feel sometimes it's kind of hard to follow me. Granted to take peace from the earth, who's granting these horsemen? And they're not really actual people necessarily. Because a horseman on a red horse doesn't mean there's a person on a red horse bringing war. It just means it's a force that's hitting the planet, basically. The force of peace with a white horse, the force of war with a red horse. Who's granting these forces to take peace from the earth? It says it was granted to take peace from the earth. It was granted. It was given to him. That's the... Exactly, right? Because this scroll is filled with all the ways that God is going to deal with the planet and the people that live here in order to bring the kingdom back and give it to his son. Yeah. So definitely, it's God that's instigating all of these. I think God instigated the peace, and I think if it were up to the Antichrist, he would love that peace to last for a long time. But God's not allowing it. God's bringing war. That men would slay one another. And this seems to be more than just killing in war, but actually an increase in murder, right? And I'll tell you why I know that, or why we believe that. A great sword was given him. When I hear the word great sword, I think of a big sword like this, right? It's not. It's a dagger. It's a dagger. It's a machaida. A dagger, not a long sword used in war, but it's for assassination. So what's going to happen is it's not just going to be war, but it's going to be more people killing each other. We're already seeing some of that, aren't we?
Yeah. And a lot of it.
Yeah. Yep. So then, Revelation 6, 5 and 6, when he broke the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, come. Now, who are these living creatures again? Those are the angelic beings around the throne, right?
Yeah, with all the eyes, the living creatures.
Yep. Come, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard something like a voice in the center of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not damage the oil and the wine. Now, I'd like to talk about each of those, actually. First of all, the black horse, it's not immediately apparent what a black horse means. Some people say, well, the black horse is death, or the black horse is pestilence. The black horse is actually famine. And how do we know that? Well, there's a pair of scales in his hand, which means that something is being measured out or rationed. This rider is carrying scales. And then even more to support that, there's a voice in the center of the four living creatures. Who's the voice in the center of the four living creatures? That's God, right? There's a voice in the center of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius. We know what a quart is, right? A quart of milk.
Take a lot of money to buy a little bit of food.
What's a denarius? That's a day's wage. So a day's wage will buy you a little milk carton full of wheat. Or you can get three milk cartons full of barley, but barley isn't very nutritious. That's kind of what you feed animals, right?
Yeah.
So it's your choice.
And then there was a limit to the famine, the last part.
Well, and do not damage the oil and the wine. So it's very interesting wording there. I didn't do a really big word study on the Greek there. But it kind of says you should conserve your oil and wine if you can. Don't damage it. Don't use it all up. Because if you've only got a little bit of wheat, you need a little bit of oil and wine to go with it because that's how they mix it together and made bread. Do not damage. Not sure. I have to look up that word, damage. Any thoughts on that?
Question.
Yeah.
Do you think that he talks about not damaging the oil and wine because it is used in correlation with Jesus so much in the New Testament?
It could be that God's saying, you can do this to the wheat, but protect the oil and the wine.
There's some sort of sacredness around those that we just don't know about.
We don't know. Yeah. Oil and the wine.
I mean, you can't live off either one of them, so what would be the point of damaging? I mean, you can live off wine for a little while.
I don't know if you can live on it, but it makes life better, I suppose.
Because for the tribulation, you'll need as much wine.
Exactly. So today's average daily wage across the United States, we think it is?
Per day.
Average daily wage in the United States.
$270.
Yeah, she read the notes. It's about $220. So for $220, you can buy a quart of wheat. That's famine. That's severe famine. Because a quart of wheat is what they say you actually need for one person for one day. So you work all day to make your $220 to buy the wheat, and then you got to go back and do the same thing tomorrow. There's nothing left over. Okay, so, well, everybody's working, I guess. Yeah. Or starving. So a quart of wheat for a denarius. The idea here is that you should have to work for a whole day to eat that day. This is severe famine. And if you look at Matthew 24:7-8, it says, in various places there will be famines and earthquakes, but all these things are merely the beginning of birth pangs. You remember that graph I showed you? The first half of the seven-year tribulation is the beginning of birth pangs. Jesus always refers to that as the beginning of birth pangs, and then the last half is the great tribulation. Yeah.
You know, Howie, we see inflation here, but by comparison to the rest of the world, you know, like, I mean, this is happening in places in Africa, South America. I mean,
but it's been happening for a while.
Crazy inflation in most places of the world.
Yeah, I once paid for a plane ticket in Bolivia with a shoebox full of bills. So I mean, it's been happening a lot. But just like local floods happen all the time, God said, I will never again flood the earth. Local floods happen all the time. He's not saying that there won't be famine and pestilence in different places on earth, but this is global.
It'll be everywhere.
Yeah, it's global. Yeah.
The word to damage, but in my version it says do not hurt instead of damage.
Do not hurt.
And it means in the Greek to be unjust, to injure, to be an offender, and to do wrong.
Yeah, and when you look at it, that's actually God saying that. God says this, a quart of wheat for a denarius and three quarts of barley for a denarius. He basically declares that there's going to be a famine, and do not damage the oil and the wine. But of course, if there's worldwide war, what do you think is going to happen to the supply chains? You can't just go down to Ingles and get anything you want, right? So the famine actually follows the war, and God declares how bad it's going to be, basically. Yeah. Don't damage it. Don't hurt it. Don't.
To be
that's interesting. Sometimes you come across a. Don't injure it. Don't what?
Be an offender of it.
Be an offender of it.
Do not do wrong.
Yeah, so that's why some commentators say he's basically saying don't do wrong to the oil and the wine. In other words, don't use it all up. Retain it as much as you can. Or God is actually saying to the black horseman, don't damage the oil and the wine. Only damage the wheat and the food. Okay? It's hard to say. You come across verses like this and you don't really know. And there's some places, especially in the Hebrew, where it's a bit ambiguous. We'll see one of those a little bit later. Revelation 6, 5, and 6.
Is the church gone at this time?
Yeah, according to what I understand, the church is gone. Yep.
It said that in that thing you told us to listen to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. You did your homework.
I did.
I read the notes and I didn't.
Nice.
It was good though.
So Revelation 6, 7 to 8, when the Lamb broke the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, come. I looked and behold an ashen horse. That horse there, by the way, is the same lady that took the first horse picture.
Oh, it's ashen.
Quite good. Ashen, you know, what's ashen?
Like a
pale.
Pale.
Kind of
grayish.
Grayish, greenish, yellow. It looks like death. Yeah. It looks like a decomposing body.
Right.
I Googled Pale Horse and all I got were Clint Eastwood movies. Pale Rider. Pale Rider. Yeah. Pale Rider. When the Lamb broke the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the four living creatures saying, come, and I looked, and an ashen horse, and he who sat on it had the name Death. And Hades was following him. Authority was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword and with famine and with pestilence and by the wild beasts of the earth. So it's a sickly pale green color. It's just disgusting. Authority was given over to them for a fourth of the earth, to basically kill a fourth of the earth. It says here in Matthew 24:9. Do I have it? Yeah. It says here in Matthew 24:9. I didn't put the whole verse up there, but it's under the second part here. Matthew 24:9 says, then they will deliver you to tribulation and they will kill you and you will be hated by all nations because of my name. And at that time, many will fall away and hate it and will fall away and will betray one another and hate one another. So the question is, you know, Jesus is speaking to his disciples 2,000 years ago about this. He knows they're not going to be there, but I think he's using this in general terms. They will hate you. Now, who are these people that he's talking about now? He's talking about Christians. Now, are they Christians that didn't get raptured before the tribulation and go into the tribulation, or are these Christians that actually converted during the tribulation? Yeah. I think there's going to be a large evangelical explosion during the tribulation because there are a lot of people who are on the fence. And when people disappear, they're like, oh no, I know what just happened. And I didn't go. I missed the plane, right? Exactly. I know I've got a Bible here somewhere. Where is it? Oh my goodness. Luke 21. I might have time to read that. It's also quite good. Luke 21, 8 to 28. Luke 21, 8 to 28. Look at that. I'm actually taking time to turn into my Bible. Matthew, Mark, Luke. 21:8-28. This is quite a nice section, actually. I'll go ahead and read it because I think we got time. So, and he said, see to it that you not be misled, for many will come in my name, saying, I am he, and the time is at hand. Do not go after them. And when you hear of wars and disturbances, do not be terrified, for these things must take place first. But the end does not follow immediately. The end he's talking about is at the end of tribulation. That's the end he's talking about. Then he continued by saying to them, nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be great earthquakes in various places, plagues, famines, and there will be terrors and great signs from heaven. But before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and will persecute you, delivering you to the synagogues and prisons, bringing you before kings and governors for my name's sake. This is all red type here, okay? It will lead to an opportunity for your testimony. What does that mean? When they start dragging you before the magistrates, you can say something, right?
You have to, yeah.
Yeah. So make up your minds not to prepare beforehand to defend yourselves. Luke is so cool. He's like, hey, this is time for you to give your testimony, but don't worry about it. Yeah? Don't need to prepare. For I will give you utterance and wisdom which none of your opponents will be able to resist or refute. So cool. But you will be delivered up even by parents and brothers and relatives and friends, and they will put some of you to death. This is a reference to where Jesus says, hey, some people think I came to bring peace. I didn't come to bring peace. I came to bring a sword. And I'll put a man against his household. Yeah.
It's just awful.
Yet not a hair of your head will perish. Now, this is very disputable, perish, because that makes it sound like they're not going to die. But the Bible is very clear that a lot of people die during the tribulation, and a lot of them are martyred. Yeah, so it really means if you stand firm during this time, your soul will live. Yeah. Sometimes Jesus talks in spiritual terms, and everybody thinks he's talking about human terms. Right? You ever notice that in the Bible? Not a hair of your head will perish. By your endurance, you will gain your lives. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her destruction is at hand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are in the midst of the city depart, and let not those who are in the country enter the city, nor stay out of the city. Because these are days of vengeance, in order that all things which are written may be fulfilled. How long did I say to read? 28. Woe to those who are with child and to those who nurse babies in those days, for there will be great distress upon the land and wrath to this people. And they will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. So God is allowing this to happen until a specific point in time where he's saying, okay, the time of the Gentiles has been fulfilled. They're not going to trample over Jerusalem anymore. And then he puts an end to it. And there will be signs in the sun and moon and stars and upon the earth, dismay among the nations, in perplexity, the roaring of the sea and the waves. So this is where people start to figure it out. Wait a minute, this is not normal. There's signs in the heavens, there's signs on the earth, there's signs in the waves. Men fainting from fear. What does that mean to faint from fear?
You just pass out.
You literally die from fear. I think so, yeah. What's the word fainting here? Maybe someone can look that up. Fainting from fear. I guess you could say fainting, but that just means to... Yeah. And the expectation of the things which are coming upon the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. That's at the end of the tribulation. But when these things begin to take place, straighten up and lift up your heads, because your redemption is drawing near. Yeah. That's pretty cool. All right. Nice. Any more thoughts on that? Ash and horse. Yeah.
I just had a question about the use of Hades.
About what?
The use of Hades in the verse.
Yes. Hades is the underworld. It's where the dead go. It's used. They also use Sheol, Hades. Yeah.
Sheol is in Ezekiel, right?
Yeah. I think Sheol comes from a Hebrew term, whereas Hades is the Greek form of the same thing. But it just means death. And of course, if you're not one of his, it's real death, right? It's you don't get to live again after that. So he says Hades follows him. That means death, and people going into Sheol will follow him. Yeah.
Curiosity question.
Mm-hmm.
This one has a three-part versus all the other horses that are released are what? So is this kind of setting up a timeline to get into those last three, like, obviously, with famine, is going to come sickness. With sickness, you're going to get
death.
Rabid creatures,
yeah.
Which in turn, attack rabid and starving creatures.
Yep.
So do we, maybe all of these are going on at the same time, or is it a domino effect?
I think one leads to the other.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, you'll have a lot coming on at the same time. Authority was given to them over a fourth of the year to kill with the sword and with famine and with pestilence and by the wild beasts of the earth. Now, that's very interesting. Are there any wild beasts in Atlanta?
In the zoo.
Yeah.
Squatters taking over homes.
There's coyotes around, right?
Coyotes.
Lack of food will kill many. And to kill with pestilence, it's a disease or a plague or other disaster of some kind. Obviously, if there's death and people aren't being buried properly, you're going to get disease. And then it says to kill with the wild beasts of the earth. They're literally untamed creatures. Your dog's not going to turn against you, okay? But these are untamed creatures that start to overrun the population centers because the population center infrastructure is bad. And I mentioned this before, Earth has over 8 billion people, so more than 2 billion will die when this fourth seal is opened. But there's another wild beast that we don't think too much about, which is probably responsible for more human deaths than anyone on the planet. What is it?
Rats.
It's a rat. Can you imagine?
You know, the Hurricane Andrew hit that reptile center and released all those anacondas.
Yeah.
That's why they got that problem today.
Because they're reproducing like crazy.
Oh, yeah, they're anacondas and
Leprechauns
all over.
And the United States is being overrun by wild boars. In fact, they're coming down from Canada and they're coming up from Florida.
Yeah.
And they're like European wild boars. They're like 2,000 pounds or 1,800 pounds. And you can actually shoot those at will. There's no season for those. If you want to go shoot wild boars, just go shoot them. Right?
Do you still watch the World Star Law thing?
What's that?
Do you still watch World Star Law? Where they, like,
these guys would get the cops called on them because they were shooting and the neighbors were mad, and then they'd be like, "Oh, we're killing boars." They're like, "Go ahead."
The word fainting with fear means heart failing them.
Their heart fails them.
To breathe out. An example is faint hearts are failing.
Yeah, yeah. So the fainting from fear really could mean that you just die of fear. Yeah. All right. Nice. Okay, we're on to the fifth seal.
It's not nice.
It's not nice, I know. Here's the fifth seal. When the Lamb broke the fifth seal, I saw underneath the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and because of the testimony which they had maintained. And they cried out with a loud voice, saying, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, will you refrain from judging and avenging our blood on those who dwell on the earth?" So judging and avenging our blood, who are these people? They became Christians, and then they were killed because of the word of God. Yeah. And the term "and those who dwell on the earth" is used throughout Revelation to mean the unsaved, the unrighteous, those who dwell on the earth. Yeah. And there was given to each of them a white robe, and they were told that they should rest for a little while longer until the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who were to be killed, even as they had been, would be completed also. So that's very interesting. It's interesting that they're under the altar. I saw underneath the altar. Do they have bodies? They don't have bodies, I don't think. They're just souls. But they were given a white robe, maybe so John could see that they were there, because souls are invisible, right? But I believe that these are souls waiting for the end of the tribulation so that they can be reunited with their bodies. Okay, and we're going to look at that in the next chapter, because there's something to say about that. So they are crying out for justice. They're crying out for justice, which is coming. They just have to wait a bit longer. They just have to wait a bit longer. And their souls, they don't have bodies, even though they were provided with robes, you know, so that John could see them. And there was given to each of them a white robe. And the Greek there is stole, a robe reaching to the feet. It goes all the way down. Yeah. It was worn by kings, priests, and people of rank. And this type of robe is given to the redeemed saints throughout Revelation. Whenever Revelation says they were dressed in white robes, they're dressed in white stole. Yeah. There's another word for robe, which is used throughout the New Testament. So here's where English is inadequate again, which just means a robe that kind of comes down to here. But these are white robes that go all the way down to your feet. And it says that they should rest for a little while longer. Why do they have to rest a little while longer? Until more people are killed. Wow, huh? Gee. It's like not enough people have been martyred yet that are coming into my kingdom. You just have to wait a little while longer. So these are definitely martyrs, and it seems like they're bodiless. It seems like they're souls. Kind of get confused, because a lot of people think that when we're in heaven, we're just little spirits floating around. We're not, okay? We're with a body. We're with a resurrection body. Now, my sister who passed away, she's probably like one of those, because she doesn't have a resurrection body. Her soul is with Jesus, but she has no body. Her earthly body's in the ground, and she hasn't been reunited with a heavenly body yet. So it may be the same type of situation here. Those of us who know loved ones who have died in Christ could be under the altar up there.
So that won't happen. Then bodies won't happen until he comes the second time or the second time.
Right. So yeah, we talked about this. It seems like there's several gatherings, right? There's the gathering before the tribulation. Then there's a gathering at the end of the tribulation. And then you've got the millennial kingdom. How does that work out? We're going to talk about that later on. Yep, until the rest of the martyrs come in. That's why they're waiting. And it's not like they're impatient, but they're just saying, "Hey, these people killed us. Are you going to, like, bring your judgment on them?" And God's like, I'm doing it now. I'm doing it now. Just wait. Yeah.
So these martyrs, they were not raptured. They weren't saved then, but they became saved after the tribulation.
That seems to be the idea, is that during the tribulation, they became Christians, they became believers. Yeah, because there's later on, we'll talk about the mark of the beast. Those who take the mark aren't in the kingdom. Those who don't take the mark. This is all tribulation stuff, right? So that seems to be the idea. Okay. 6:12 to 17, this is the end of chapter 6. I looked when he broke the sixth seal, and there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth made of hair, and the whole moon became like blood. And the stars of the sky fell to the earth as a fig tree casts its unripe figs when shaken by a great wind. When you go back to Matthew 24, you'll see that he talks about exactly the same thing. Signs in the stars and the heavens, and then he talks about the fig tree. So it's really parallel. It's really interesting. And he says this, the sky was split apart like a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. Now that's weird, okay? What does that mean, every mountain and island were moved out of their places? Earthquake and continental drift like we've never seen, right? Or something, right? And the sky was split apart as a scroll. That comes out of a hymn. Do you know which hymn it is? And the sky will be split apart like a scroll. Yeah.
Why don't you sing it for us
there? Just hum a little bit.
It is well with my soul.
Oh.
And no, I'm not singing it. So let's look at this real quick. Signs and catastrophic events on earth and in the heavens. Matthew 24:29. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Matthew 24:29. Let's include this part here. I told you that Matthew parallels this really closely. You know, when Jesus is telling his disciples all these things, he's thinking about what's happening in the end times, and John gets an image of that. So 24:29, and the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming with great cloud. And then he says in verse 32, now learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and it puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. Even so, you too, when you see all these things, recognize that he is near, right at the door. So he talks about the fig tree here, and he talks about the fig tree in Matthew 24. Interesting, huh? And there's a great earthquake. The word for great is mega. It's a mega earthquake. It's not just your standard run-of-the-mill 7.0 on the Richter scale. This is a mega earthquake, okay? Unlike any other earthquake that the earth has ever experienced, the sun becomes black. We don't know why or how, but perhaps due to the ash from tectonic and volcanic activity, because the earth is just really getting battered. It's really getting shaken. And then the whole moon became like blood. You know, a blood moon is caused by a lunar eclipse. When the earth moves between the sun and the moon, that's a blood moon. That's what they call a blood moon, but this is different. That's probably way more than this. Way more. And then the stars of the sky fell to earth. Comets or meteors, yeah. And then the sky was split apart like a scroll. The sky was split apart like a scroll, some kind of rift in heaven, like an old scroll that breaks when you roll it and unroll it. You know the scrolls, you keep them rolled up for a long time, and of course you don't know, but it's 2,000 years ago, right? You open an old dry scroll, and it might just snap, yeah? And there's a very interesting verse in Isaiah. Let's look at that. I did put it on my page here. In Isaiah 40:22, and this phrase occurs throughout Isaiah and in some Psalms, as far as I know. In Isaiah 40:22, it says, it is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers. And then he says this, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. Very interesting, huh? The whole idea is people are like, oh, you know, there's no way that the universe is only 6,000 years old or whatever it is, 7,000 years old. There's no way it's just that old because it's 17.5 billion light years to the farthest star. Well, why is that a problem for God? He created the heavens and then just went like this whoosh, and stretched them out like a curtain. And this appears many, many times in the Bible, stretching the heavens out like a curtain. So why can't the heavens like split apart somehow? Maybe it's another dimension. We don't know. But this gives you an idea of the unprecedented shaking that's going on, not only on Earth, but in the universe. And then unprecedented continental drift. The Earth is reeling. For the Lord's indignation, Isaiah 34, for the Lord's indignation against all the nations It's against all the nations. And his wrath against all their armies. He has utterly destroyed them. He has given them over to slaughter, so their slain will be thrown out, and their corpses will give off their stench, and the mountains will be drenched with their blood. And the host of heaven will wear away, and the sky will be rolled up like a scroll, and their hosts will also wither away as a leaf withers from the vine, or as one withers from the fig tree. There's the fig tree reference again, huh? Interesting. You know, most of us aren't doing our daily devotions in verses like this. We're just not, right? But they're there, right? They're there. And then what happens? Fall on us. Then the kings of the earth and the great men and the commanders and the rich and the strong and every slave and free man hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the presence of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who is able to stand? I think it's interesting that these people aren't crying out to God. They're crying out to the mountains. It's like, no, we don't have anything to do with God. But if you mountains would just please fall on us, because whatever we would experience if you caved in on us and fell on top of us is going to be a lot better than what's going on right now. Of course, they don't really know, do they? They don't really know. The unrighteous inhabitants of the earth now know that God is involved here, and they want nothing to do with him. Until now, it was kind of like life like normal. It was kind of life like normal. Matthew 24:37, this is an interesting verse. For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. And I can just picture the scene. I mean, Noah built the ark for like 120 years or something like that. And people out there are making fun of him and saying, don't be stupid. There's not going to be any rain. It never rains. And then they got carried away when the flood came. And they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then there will be two men in the field, and one will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and one will be left. Note that this is taking... This taking of one at the mill will be staying there, and one will be taken, one will be left. This taking is in the context of judgment, not the rapture. This is in the context of judgment. A lot of people point to this verse and they say, hey, look, here. This is happening at the end of the tribulation. It's after the sixth seal, and someone's at the mill, and they're being taken, and the other one stays. The ones that are being taken, I think, are actually being killed, to be honest with you. I think they are, because in the end, it says that the Lord opens his mouth and slays all the righteous. So going from the tribulation into the new millennium, there are no unbelievers. Zero unbelievers. Everybody who survives the tribulation goes into the millennial kingdom alive. And anyone who doesn't survive the tribulation goes and hangs out under the altar until they get their bodies. Crazy. Any thoughts on that? There will be no unbelievers going from the tribulation into the millennial kingdom. He kills all the unbelievers with the sword of his mouth. Which is what? What's the sword of his mouth? Like, you had this, right? You had this and you didn't listen to it. I'm going to use the same word that you had and didn't listen to actually kill you. Wow.
So being that we're on the sixth seal, more than likely all the unrighteous have taken the mark of the beast. That's why they're hiding.
Right, and that's why it's a good idea to look at this as epochs and time, because we're only in chapter 6 of Revelation. There's 22 chapters in this book. So there's going to be a lot more detail coming out about some of the events that happened during this time, right? So it's kind of a table of contents. When you open a book and you look and look what the chapters are, you look at the table of contents and you see what each chapter is about. Because these seal judgments span the entire tribulation. But then inside the seventh seal, which we're going to talk about next week, are all the trumpet judgments. Seven of those inside the seventh seal. Now, we don't know exactly how much time those are, but we know that it's towards the end of tribulation. Then inside the last trumpet judgment are all the bowl judgments. And they're the worst of all. They're the worst of all. So, it gets pretty dicey down here.
Maybe it's the worst people that are left that are getting the worst of it.
Could
be. Like the leaders and the rulers.
Yeah.
all the people in charge.
Yeah.
And then they really get it handed to them.
Yeah. And that's one of the challenges about eschatology is it doesn't say, and then on September 29th, you know, this happens. There's no dates given. What you do is you get a chronology. It's a series of things that happen, and we're pretty sure that those happen literally and chronologically, because John keeps saying, and after this I saw, and then I saw, okay? So he's putting time words in there, but he's not looking at his Timex and telling you what time it was that he saw that happen, and that's why it's a little bit, we're not so sure about the timing. Yeah. And then he asks this question, who is able to stand? Who is able to stand? And chapter 7 is actually going to answer this question. We still have time. Nice. So let me hit you with a little bit about the Antichrist. I know you were really dying to find out who this guy is. I want to give you this to so that you can sort of be thinking about it, and then when you see the things that we talk about, you'll say, oh yeah, I remember Howard said that. The Antichrist is the little horn in Daniel 7:8. So in Daniel 7:8, it talks about a little horn that arises, which means someone who's pretty insignificant, and he arises and actually conquers, okay? He forms part of the unholy trinity. That's what I'm calling the unholy trinity, which is Satan, the Antichrist, and the false prophet. Satan, we know who he is. He's a fallen angel. The Antichrist is a man empowered by Satan. And the false prophet is actually another person that actually prophesies falsely about the Antichrist. And he's sometimes known as the second beast, and we'll see that later on. But he's a mere man. He's empowered by Satan. He appears to have died and then is resurrected again in Revelation 13:3. Now, I don't know if that's actually true. I'd find it actually hard to believe that Satan can perform a miracle like that. But somehow he gets a mortal wound, and then he's resurrected and raised to life again. Notice how it parallels the gospel. Satan's the great deceiver and the great copyright stealer, or whatever you want to call it, the plagiarizer. Yeah. And a lot of people are like, oh, this is the Messiah. He's here. He died and rose again. And they follow him. Okay. That comes in Revelation 13. He speaks against God. He persecutes the saints of God. He attempts to make changes to Jewish calendars and feast dates. And all of these are supported by scripture. He will remain in power for about 3.5 years from what we can tell. He signs a treaty with Israel and then breaks the agreement after 3.5 years. He desecrates the Jewish temple with idolatry. He basically does whatever he wants and makes himself God. He sets himself up as God. And he will prosper in all he does until God's wrath is completed on him. Another really interesting thing, he has no desire for women. The Hebrew here is ambiguous. There are a lot of people that have sort of conjectured what that means.
Where do you get that scripture?
It comes out of Daniel 11. Yeah. Let me just read a few verses on some of these. Daniel 7:25. Daniel has a lot of prophecies to say about this end time, this exact same time. Daniel 7:25 says, he will defy the Most High and oppress the holy people of the Most High. He will try to change their sacred festivals and laws, and they will be placed under his control for a time, times, and half a time. A time, times, and a half a time. 3.5. Okay. And why do they do that? Why don't they just say 3.5 years? It's poetic. It's a way to just put an underline on something. And then in Daniel 9:27, it says this, the ruler will make a treaty with the people for a period of one set of seven, but after half this time, he will put an end to the sacrifices and offerings, and as a climax to all his terrible deeds, he will set up a sacrilegious object that causes desecration until the fate decreed for this defiler is finally poured out on him. Now, I'm reading from the New Living Translation here, because when they say the abomination of desolation, you got to be a theologian to know what they're even talking about. What does that mean, the abomination of desolation? What that really means is he sets up a living, breathing, talking statue of himself in the sanctuary of God and asks everyone to worship it. Now, you can imagine in the age of electronics and AI that that's now possible.
Yeah.
And people are going to be, whoa, that statue is like not a statue. It's like really alive, right? So this is the idea here. And then this last part, it says, then the king will do as he pleases, then he will exalt and magnify himself above every god. And this is from Daniel 11. And will speak monstrous things against the God of gods, which is God, and he will prosper until the indignation is finished. Whose indignation? God's indignation. For that which is decreed will be done. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers. He doesn't worship any other gods or for the desire of women. Nor will he show regard for any other god, for he will magnify himself above all. This whole idea of the desire of women, the Hebrew is kind of ambiguous, and you can read a lot of commentators and they'll tell you one thing or another thing. It could be that he's probably unmarried, or a homosexual, or just completely disinterested in women. Or he's too busy, whatever. It's like, I'm going to dominate this planet, and I don't care about all the rest of the trappings that go with it. Don't know. But anyway, that's probably all you can handle today about him. Let's jump into chapter 7. Any thoughts on that?
Aren't there some that you think are going to be the Antichrist and there's not?
Yeah, because in John, in the book of 1 John, which if you ever wonder if you're a Christian or not, read 1 John. Uh-huh. If you don't know if you're a Christian, you got to read 1 John. It'll tell you. But in 1 John, he talks about, you know, you've heard that the Antichrist is coming, and indeed many Antichrists have come. Yeah. Antichrist is anything that's against Christ. And there are plenty of them out there today. Plenty of them. Yeah. But this is Antichrist with a capital A is one man. So, yeah.
How long do you think he'll be here on the earth before? How long do you think the Antichrist will come before the end?
How long do I think it'll be? Well, don't quote me, but I think it's 10 years and it's over. 10 years from now, it's over. I could be wrong.
So do you think it's already here?
Do I think what's already here?
The Antichrist is already
here? I think he's probably alive right now.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but they thought that about Hitler. You should have heard the things they said about Hitler. Hitler's a great man. He's going to bring peace to the whole region, and we really need to get on his side. And then all of a sudden he turned. It's the same situation here. I mean, if you look up some of the things that people said about Hitler, you'd be like, wait a minute, are they talking about the same guy? And Churchill was the only one who wasn't deceived. He said, I don't trust this guy. I don't think it's going to go well. He's going to get an army, and then he's going to take over Europe. And sure enough, that's what he did. Yeah. So, you could say he was an Antichrist, can't you? Was Hitler an Antichrist? Absolutely. Did you see what he did to the Jews? And Revelation talks about that. It talks about how the beast wants to devour the child that came from the woman. And there's symbology there, symbolism. And we'll talk about that. But he's always trying to kill the Jews. He wants to get rid of them because he knows they're God's chosen people. That's why we have to support Israel. You know, and I'm not for killing Palestinians, don't get me wrong, but I am for Israel being able to feel like they're in safety and peace and not having a bunch of, you know, rebels next door to them that always want to kill them and say death to Israel. Who would want to live like that?
Well, throughout the Bible, the Lord told his people to go and kill all inhabitants.
So yeah.
When they're hunting down Hamas, that's basically
right. Yeah. Now, Israel isn't anything like the biblical Israel. I mean, mostly secular now, right? But they're still Israel. They're still God's people. So, yeah, it's a tough situation, and you see all the divisive protests, and you see the guy who's lit himself on fire. Oh, gosh.
And I mean, the college campuses are crazy.
Okay, so Revelation 7. And after this, I saw, after this, this happened next. It's a new vision. Yes. After this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth. It's interesting that they've done some studies, and they realize that the winds do come from four different directions on the earth. Anyway, so that no wind would blow on the earth or on the sea or on any tree. Now, what does that even mean? The angels were holding back the four winds. It's almost like all the cataclysm that's happening on the planet is causing winds to blow. And the angels are holding the winds back for a time. And what are they holding them back for? And I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun, which is which side? East, right? Having the seal of the living God, so this is one of God's angels, and he cried out with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, do not see ya. Is that something I said? saying, do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the bondservants of our God on their foreheads. Huh. Now, who are these bondservants? Who are these people? From the tribe of Judah, 12,000 were sealed. From the tribe of Reuben, 12,000. From the tribe of Gad, 12,000.
That's the group that's able to stand.
Yep. Who's able to stand? This is the group that's able to stand. What it seems like is that there's 12,000 from each tribe of Israel who who have come to Christ, and these people will be instrumental in preaching the gospel on earth during the tribulation. And God's going to mark them with a seal. And what does that even mean? And we're going to find out, actually, what that seal means. But not until Revelation 14. But I'll tell you right now what it is. Revelation 14:1 says this, "Then I looked, and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his name and the name of his Father written on their foreheads." That's them. That's them. So what it seems like is, even though a lot of Christians are going to be martyred during that time, and all the unbelievers are going to be killed by the sword that comes out of Jesus' mouth, that these 144,000 will be always preaching the gospel on planet Earth during the whole tribulation. Yeah? And so the angels are basically holding back the four winds so that God can say, "I'm going to stamp each one." Yeah? They get the mark.
I was listening to Hal Lindsey recently.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, think of the 144,000 as 144,000 Billy Grahams.
Billy Grahams. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And then some people look at Revelation and say, oh, 144,000, the Jehovah's Witnesses do this. They're like, Jehovah's Witnesses? Oh, well, that's us. Well, what? What are you talking about? And then some people say, well, these are Christians. No. It's obvious that they're from the tribes. Now, does Israel know who's in what tribe? They don't.
They don't.
Anymore. Because in 70 AD, the Romans sacked Jerusalem, burned down the temple, completely destroyed it. All their historical records are gone. No one knows, except for one person. God knows.
So if we follow the timeline and if we just pretend it's literal, there will be 144,000 Jews preaching and spreading God's word in the 7 years.
Correct.
But if he doesn't stamp them until the 7 years, that means those 144,000 will not be martyred or killed during those 7 years.
Yeah, it's almost like there must be some kind of protection. And, I mean, the numbers are too even, right? It's not like 12,000 of each tribe. I mean, who determined that? Well, God did.
So, but that would kind of be how that timeline would run, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're going to have to live through it all. Even though they weren't saved to begin with, they
were
saved after.
Right.
They're going to have to live through
it. And that's why I believe that the tribulation is as much about Israel as it is about anything. It's about God's judgment on the planet and on unbelievers and those who dwell on the earth, but it's also about bringing Israel in. We're going to see that as well. How are we doing on time?
Well, it looks like at least 144,000.
Right. So, you know, this is God's seal for these saints as opposed to the mark of the beast. 12,000 from each tribe.
Could you go through that timeline again? Because I'm sort of thinking through when you said about the 144,000.
So the seventh seal hasn't opened yet. We're on the sixth seal. So it's probably during the last half of the tribulation when God identifies these 144,000 and puts the seal on their foreheads.
In the last half of the three.
The seventh seal hasn't opened yet. And inside the seven seals are so many judgments. The seventh seal has so many judgments that it'll make your head spin.
Trump, all of those. I mean, there are more than just those
seven trumpets and seven bowls.
Yeah.
Okay, so after these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude, which no one could count, from every nation and all the tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes. There's that stole again. And palm branches were in their hands, and they cried out with a loud voice, saying, "Salvation to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." And all the angels were standing around the throne and around the elders and the four living creatures, and they fell on their faces before the throne and worship God, saying, "Amen, blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might to be to our God forever and ever. Amen." So these are saints, these people who are here standing before the throne and before the Lamb clothed in white robes. It's probably the saints that were under the altar as souls. And then more have been added to it. That's why they were waiting, right? So now they're standing before the throne, and they're clothed with the same stole. Yeah, and what are they doing there? What are they doing? They're worshiping for sure. Yeah, they're worshiping. Yeah. Now, when we do, next week we're going to do four chapters. I can't do this detail next week. I just can't. I have to cherry pick some stuff. But we'll find the most interesting things. Then one of the elders answered, saying to me, these who are clothed in the white robes, who are they and where have they come from? So one of the elders is asking John. One of the elders says, who are these guys? And John says, my Lord, you know. And he said to me, and notice Lord is lowercase. He's not calling him Jesus. It's just an elder. My Lord, you know. And he said to me, these are the ones who come out of the great tribulation, and they have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Yeah. So it's interesting. When he says, these are the ones who have come out of the great tribulation, a lot of people look at that verse and say, aha, it's the rapture. So we get raptured at the end of the tribulation. Of course, we haven't had the seventh seal yet. But it says, these are the ones who come out of the great tribulation. But are there any English majors in here? That term come out is in what's called middle voice. Middle voice is not a common English expression. It's not a common English construction. But middle voice means that they had something to do with it and someone else had something to do with it. When we talk about the rapture, it's passive. When we're passive in the rapture, we don't do anything. We just go, pew, right? And so the idea is that it's like they kept coming. It's like they kept coming out. So it's a process. So it's rendered in middle voice. These are the ones who come out or have been coming out of the great tribulation. So it's a process rather than an event. And they have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. So these are probably the martyred saints who were under the altar in 6:9, back in chapter 6, plus many more since, because those souls were waiting for more martyrs to come in, right?
So they have the
body. Yep. And the idea is these martyred saints lived into the tribulation. So these are people who weren't Christians before the tribulation happened. They lived into the tribulation. They were redeemed during the tribulation, and they came out of it over time through death. That's the best interpretation we can come up with on that. Now, I just want to say one more thing because I'm getting close to time here. Please note that the blood of Jesus has a cleansing and whitening effect. Washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Now, I've always found that fascinating because blood, we're always trying to get blood out of something. It stains red. And when it dries, it's brown. Somehow Jesus' blood is cleansing. And you know, you could say, well, it's all spiritual, Howard, right? I think there's more to it than that. I think it's not just spiritual, because how can you take robes and wash them in blood and they come out white? Because his blood is so pure and so holy and so amazing that when you wash in the blood of Jesus, you come out pure and holy and spotless, no stains whatsoever. They will hunger no longer. And he's talking about these saints. For this reason, they are before the throne of God, and they will serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will spread his tabernacle over them. What's tabernacle? Yeah, it's a tent, right? It's some kind of something that you go under. And he who sits on the throne will spread his tabernacle over them. They will hunger no longer. Do you think they hungered during the tribulation?
Yeah.
They won't thirst anymore, nor will the sun beat down on them, nor any heat. For the Lamb in the center of the throne will be their shepherd, and he will guide them to springs of the water of life, and God will wipe every tear from their eyes. You see, that's the heart of God, because God is pouring out his judgment on the earth, but the ones that come to him, he loves and he cares for, and he comforts them. He puts a tabernacle over them. That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. I would call that loving relief from the torment that they experienced during the tribulation. Because death is a relief. I said this at my sister's memorial, and this comes right out of Ecclesiastes. Solomon says, the day of your death is better than the day of your birth. But only if you're a believer. Otherwise, it's way worse. Yeah. Well, any other thoughts on that before I let you go? It's, it got hot again in here, didn't it? Yeah, I was going to change clothes. I was going to put on a tie and nice shoes, and I was going to shave. And my wife said, honey, just go like that. You look fine. So for next time, and some of you came in late, so I'll show you.
Okay, you want us to raise our
hand? I'm not naming names.
Oh,
no.
Okay.
I don't know if you saw it. You probably saw this. These are the two different types of scrolls that are pictured artistically. I kind of like that one. That's cool.
I've been online all day.
Yeah, you're all over it. So then this is the one we did. Now the seventh seal we didn't do. The silence in heaven comes in chapter 8. So that chapter 8 actually begins the trumpet judgments, which are inside the seventh seal. But there's a silence in heaven for a half an hour. That's very interesting. Wait a minute. Heaven is silent for half an hour? Why? Why is there silence in heaven for half an hour? I'm going to talk about that. So you can also listen to this before this week's session. There's the PowerPoint. There's the class notes. And then I'll put the audio recording on tonight. So we went about an hour and 20 minutes tonight, which is actually pretty good. Is that right?
That's John Nicholson. That was good.
That was a good one, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I thought I kind of made that mandatory because.
You have homework.
Yeah. it was my good. Commentary, the one, yeah. The same one that says the four creatures are God's pets.
God's pets.
Yeah, he says it's a contrast between the hymns that go before and the crash to fall.
Huh.
Silence in heaven for half an hour.
Yeah, that's what he says it is.
Yeah.
A contrast.
Between the hymns that go before and the crash
to fall. Yeah, I mean, that's one of those verses where you have to read it, and you have to read the verses around it, and you have to say, God, what does this actually mean? Some people say that heaven is silent because what about what's about to happen? They're like, oh. It's like, everyone's breath is taken away, and they're like, oh, no. So anyway, well, thanks for coming, you guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right.
Good luck.